This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is David Kunzman, a host of the New Books Network, and today we'll be talking with Wolfgang Marx, who edited a volume commemorating the composer Georgi Ligeti's centenary entitled I Don't Belong Anywhere, published by Breitpuls in 2022. Wolfgang Marx is an associate professor in musicology at the University of College Dublin. His main research interests include Georgi Ligeti, the representation of death in music, post-truth, and music, and the theory of musical genres. He also co-edited on Georgi Ligeti, entitled Georgi Ligeti, of Foreign Lands and Strange Sounds, published in 2011. I hope you enjoy the interview. So we usually like to ask our guests before we start the interview just about their general background and how they came to write or edit their current work. So Wolfgang, how did you come to edit this volume on Georgi Ligeti?
Yes, I am a musicologist, and I studied in the city of Hamburg in Germany, where Ligeti lived at the time. So you could actually meet him in the opera house, in the concert hall, or sometimes even on the road. And also we had one of our professors, Konstantin Floros, who researched him, who had written a book on him, and who invited him every now and then to give a talk. So there was a connection somehow. And one of my first larger projects with two friends, still as a graduate student, was working on one of the big pieces, Lontano, and that became my first major publication, a book with three authors. I was one of them. And ever since, I have been working on them. I was interested in his music, and when I moved to Ireland, that continued. I've edited another book on him 12 years ago, and this one now last year, because we are now in the centenary year, and so this is a good moment to focus on him again and have another look at where we stand with regard to his work, what's interesting in his music, and maybe also in his personality for us today.
So just to get into the figure Georgi Ligeti, where does he stand in the history of 20th century music?
Yeah, he was born, well, it's a centenary year, so he was born in 1923. He started composing around 1940 as a student, as a secondary student still. Studied then composition in Budapest. He was Hungarian, ethnic Hungarian, but also Jewish, and he was in that part of Hungary in Transylvania, which had become Romanian after the First World War. So that meant he was a minority already as Hungarian in Romania, and then within that another minority, Jewish. And after the end of the Second World War, which he just about survived, many of his family did not. And he then moved to Budapest, studied there, and became a composer. And had a few years as a composer there, which was tricky because it was the communist regime. The Cold War was emerging, and there was very tight control of what composers were allowed to do. After the failed uprising in 1956, he and his wife fled to Austria, like many other Hungarians, and that's when his career really took off. He became acquainted with Western composers and Western compositions and styles, and that made his unique style emerging that he then developed from around late 50s, early 60s, the micropolyphonic style that he became famous for. And ever since, until he stopped composing around 2002, he was one of the dominant figures in Western composition. He forged his own path, and I'm sure we will talk about details of that throughout this interview, and became a model for an alternative way. There was then the big discussion between people who had very rigid structures and rules of how to compose, the so-called total serialism by Pierre Boulez or Karlheinz Stockhausen. And then people who said, let it all do or go without much regulation, without any rules. People like John Cage, it's all chance, it's all undetermined. And he tried to find something in between, something between enormous determinism and chaos. He was also interested in lots of scientific theories and developments, and also in literature and other cultures. And he had later developed an interest in chaos theory and fractal geometry, for example, which is about this, about self-identity and about the large scale and the small scale and how things relate to each other and how determinism and chaos might interact. And so he became, I think, one of the most important composers of the second half of the 20th century in a Western context that a lot of people were influenced by.
So the title of the volume, I Don't Belong Anywhere, surely it's referring to his minority status and I guess his not belonging to any particular compositional school but foraging his own way. Was this do you think this was a conscious reaction against people like Boulez, Stockhausen, and like you said, people on the other side, people like Cage and maybe Warren Feldman? Or was this something that was natural?
It was probably a mix of both. I mean, he had this thing he always said. He said that not just in this particular interview. This is from an interview with a Russian musicologist, Marina Lobanova, in another book. He said things like that a lot. He felt once he had left Hungary and had to leave Hungary, he was uprooted in a way. He was then coming to the country of the people who had killed many of his family members. And he settled there and he was probably okay there, but it was always something that was not entirely his home. He was fluent in many languages, in obviously Hungarian and Romanian, in German and English, in French and Swedish. Because in the 60s he got a lot of gigs teaching, and also compositions were commissioned from him from Sweden. And so he was clearly somebody who lived in the world, even though he spent most of his time after he left Hungary in Vienna, then in the city of Hamburg, and then the final 3 years again in Vienna. But yes, he had always this feeling that the quote continues, he's part of the intelligentsia of Europe. And that is something that is transnational, that is not Hungarian or German or French or Spanish or whatever. It's more like a certain class. But he felt he belongs to all of this and to nothing in particular.
So getting back to the book, in one of the essays, it was mentioned that there was a sound experiment on Lotano, one from 2005 to 20, the other one taken from 2021. What did you find surprising, or what do you think was brought out by these listener responses on the piece Lotano?
Yeah, this is the essay by Britta Sveers, who's a professor in Bern in Switzerland. And she was actually one of my co-authors of the book I mentioned earlier, my first major publication on Lontano. And when we did this, this was published in 1997 originally, we did what everybody almost does who works on Ligeti. We look at what the composer himself says about his associations, his ideas when he wrote this. He has spent an awful lot of time talking about this. He has given many interviews, has written many texts, given many speeches. So when you go to Czech, and just did that about 6 weeks ago, go to Basel in Switzerland, where all his sketches and letters, all his writings are. It is, you can spend weeks there going through all that stuff and find more and more. And so everybody focuses on the associations that Ligeti has. In the case of this particular piece, Lontano, from 1967, he names a number of ideas, a number of influences. For instance, etchings by 18th century Italian artist Piranesi, Carceri d'Invenzione, the prisons of the imagination, which create impossible geometric structures that look in three dimensions couldn't exist. A bit like some of these things by the Dutch artist Maurits Escher. We have things that are also impossible in three dimensions, but can be drawn in two dimensions. And so he also said he is influenced or inspired by a painting by the German 16th century painter Altdorfer, The Battle of Alexander, which is a massive painting in a museum in Munich, which covers an entire wall. And there's one corner where the sun breaks through thick clouds, and it's a very bright light that sort of illuminates an otherwise very dark landscape. And the third one is an ode by Keats. And so, yes, you go along, you look at that, you say, okay, where is there a moment in the music where that might be equivalent to that breakthrough of light, for example, and you find one and you talk about it. And that's fine. That's what everybody has done all the time for decades now. What Britta has done is what I think nobody has done yet so far. Forget about what he says. Look at what people listening to it actually think or feel or perceive. So she went to some of her students in two different institutions and played them the piece and said, okay, what do you feel? Can you give us an association? What kind of emotion does it trigger? What kind of association do you have? And it turns out it's not quite like what Ligeti said. Of course, you can't expect them to specifically say, oh, it is like that painting. That would never work. But is it some about the emotions that come out are not as positive as Ligeti sometimes evokes them or describes them. And there's certainly something that I think is a good idea to pursue further. It would be interesting to do that with other pieces and to say, okay, this is what Ligeti has said. This is what he intended. This is what influenced him. But do people actually sense a similar feeling, a similar emotion? Do they have a similar reaction when actually listening to it, particularly if it didn't tell them all that beforehand? And it turns out that's not necessarily the case. And so far, this opens up really a new way of engaging with Ligeti's music, which I think might lead to further studies of a similar nature.
That sort of reminds me of someone like Roland Barthes, when he mentions the death of the author, this might be the death of the composer, maybe?
Yes, I mean, that is something that, in a way, it's not new. The death of the composer started not long after the death of the author, some 40, 50 years ago. And what we discover in our post-truth world in which we live today is that even the author was never really dead, because this is not about the book, but if you look at a movie like Tar that was in the cinemas or still is to this day, where the argument is it true, as is argued at the beginning, can the artist be separated from the piece of art, from the work? And the film tells us, no, it can't. It's impossible. And the artist's behavior influences how the art is perceived. And in a way, that is the general attitude today, I think, and we've learned that why the theory was there, that the death of the author, we should only focus on our own reaction, and the work exists on its own once it has been created. Certainly today, that's not true, and that's not what happens in practice. We are always associating the artist, the artist's life, and the artist's behavior with how the work is perceived and how the work is performed, and certain things are not performed if or are not displayed, are not in any way received, if we have a problem with the artist.
In another essay by Manfred Stank, he explores Ligeti's I guess, influences on being influenced on older compositional techniques. Was this a normal thing for Ligeti, or just a few at a certain era, or just a few pieces?
No, that happened all the time. And in fact, that happens probably with most composers all the time, but Ligeti talked about it a lot. And also Ligeti combined influences from many different directions at the same time. In this particular case, this is about particularly one of his piano etudes, Galamborong, which is from the later, mid to late 80s. And during that period, he was influenced by two things. He was influenced on the one hand by the discovery of particularly African music, so of non-European musics, and particularly the drumming patterns in African music that also, for instance, influenced people like Steve Reich, but in different ways. And the other one was indeed this early or this high medieval Ars Subtilior, or more generally, the 14th, 15th century polyphony that is incredibly complex. They developed a notation that is allows them around that period to run different parts, as it were, at different speeds or in different breakdowns, which so it's not just like in normal, let's say, Western or tonal Western music, where you, if you have a polyphonic fugue, you still have the same time signature. So you wouldn't change that. You have something that runs against something else. It comes in a bit later, but it still runs in common time or in 3-4 and 6-4, whatever it is. But what happens there is you can have the same melody running against itself at a different speed or at a different breakdown, whereby in one part, maybe one unit is divided up into two smaller units. We normally, and of course, have one half note breaking down into two quarters, breaking down into eighths. That's what why they are named this way. We can also have, of course, a division by three, which is not the standard thing, but of course you can do it. You can have triplets, you can have quintuplets, sextuplets, whatever, but you always have to notate that. It's complicated. It's not the normal thing. For them at the time, the triple division was a normal thing, and they could have two against three, so you would have something that has a dotted half against a single half, and then a dotted quaver against a single quaver, and so on. And so the one part would be 50% slower because of all the dots, but it would still be notated exactly the same way. They would exactly only notate one line, and two different people would sing it in different ways because they knew I divide by three, you divide by two. And then they had sometimes colored them in red, or at this time even some notates in half red. So that means I normally do three, division by three, but at this point I only do two, or the other way around. I normally divide in two, but at this point I divide in three. So it gives you an effect like a hemiola or so. It's something that is incredibly complicated, and it was incredibly a small number of pieces that were written this way, but he was influenced by that because what he wanted to do was write music that is rhythmically very complicated, very complex. He also discovered an American composer living in Mexico at the time, Conlon Nancarrow, who wrote stuff like that for player piano, for an automatic piano, which allowed him to do incredibly complicated ratios of tempi against each other, which human beings could never play. But it inspired Ligeti to say, okay, from all these angles, from African percussion music, from this medieval, late medieval, a highly complex rhythmic music structure, and also from what Nancarrow does, how can I try to do something new? As a composer, you always want to do something new, something original, something that hasn't been done this way before. And what Manfred Starnke does in this particular essay is he talks about the one particular source that he discovered, and he was studying with Ligeti at the time, and then became his teaching assistant at the Conservatoire Repertoire in Hamburg. So he talks a lot about what the atmosphere was like in the class, where lots of people came from different countries and continents and brought in whatever they discovered. So new pieces, also popular music, for example, that influenced Ligeti. And he talks about this particular piece, Angelorum Salat, by a composer named Rodericus, about whom we know next to nothing, like about many other people from that period, which is one of these incredibly complex, rhythmically intricate pieces. And he looks at that and looks at this particular etude, Galamborong, and shows how certain ideas that are present in that piece from about 1400 can also be found in this piece from the 1980s. But it's always complex. It's all never a single, it's never clear. It's only that influences it. He picks that now because it's an interesting comparison. But you can also do something like that, and it has been done indeed elsewhere, about ideas that come from, say, pygmies and their music in Central Africa, or indeed with Nankaro's music for player piano.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Are the influences so abstracted and fragmented in the composition that you wouldn't know where it came from? Or
no, you can't recognize it specifically. It's more the principle. Ligeti said many times, I'm never copying one-to-one. I'm never doing exactly the same thing. I find interesting the concept, and then I take the concept and use it in a different way. And that way, it's never a copy. It's always something new and something unique. And anyone who tries to say, is it exactly that? Where can I find the source? Will never fully succeed. You can find ideas, you can find concepts, you can find principles. You can never find an exact copy. He didn't like literal copying. He did it once or twice, particularly in his opera, which is a bit earlier, from the late 70s, Le Grand Macabre. But he didn't like what was then regarded the general postmodern idiom, which was neotonal, and his music is never entirely tonal. Some of it was when he was still in Hungary, because that was required in order to have it performed. But since he came to the West, he became an atonal composer. And becomes someone who is inspired by, who looks at principles also in the non-musical parts. I recently had a chat with Heinz Otto Peitgen, a mathematician who was a friend of Ligeti's, and who was in Germany developing these concepts of fractal geometry and in the 1980s and 90s, and they met in the 1980s. And he said the same about that. Ligeti was inspired by this mathematical concept, and he found a principle at work that he himself also wanted to realize in his music. But it's not a copy. It's something that he felt that enriches his view of what he does and how he does it. But it's not something where you can then go and say, and go back and say, is this something that if he hadn't encountered fractal geometry, he would have never have written this piece? And probably he would have written something very similar still. He was inspired. He incorporated aspects of it. He followed an outline. And he also talked about it a lot. Some of his interviews talk a lot, documentaries, about things like fractal geometry, for example. And he was quite knowledgeable about that. So he showed that he had lots of connections to all sorts of areas, literature, of course, as well, poetry, as well as novels in different languages, because he could read quite a few languages. So inspiration came from anywhere, but that means you can never pin down one particular source.
In your answer, you mentioned what's usually become a buzzword now for lots of different issues, the word postmodern. And you mentioned in the introduction in a question, what do Ligeti and his music have to say to us in our post-postmodernist age? What did you mean by post-postmodernist?
Yeah, that's a wordplay. When he wrote this opera, Le Grand Macabre, in 1978, he said he was his conception originally was for an anti-opera, an opera that goes against the grain of what opera is usually meant to be. But then someone else came along, Maurizio Kagel, and wrote a piece called Staatstheater, State Theater, that was already an anti-opera the way Ligeti had imagined it. So he sort of cracked a joke and said, now I have to write an anti-anti-opera. And that became that piece from 1978. So I was referring back to that when I said, is he a post-postmodernist? Because he didn't like being labeled that. Several people did that, particularly in the 1980s, because his style took a turn, as some perceived it, towards not quite tonal music again, but using melodies again, which he hadn't done before to the same extent, and becoming, some said, a bit more conservative. He didn't think it like that. And he regarded people as postmodern, for instance, the American minimalist composers, or also some European minimalist composers. That is entirely tonal, although not quite the same way that tonal music used to be in previous centuries. And he didn't like that. So he rejected the term, but of course, you are not in control. So lots of people still applied it to him. And I feel to some extent he was a bit postmodern because he was influenced by lots of other people, as we just discussed, and other styles and other even extra musical ideas. But for me, the main difference is if what you make of all that, when you put it all together, if that becomes something that is more than the sum of its parts, if it becomes something that is not entirely orally reliant on the source, then I think it transcends postmodernism in a way, and I think he got to that point. So in a purely technical sense, because there are things you can trace back as principles, as concepts, as structures, you might be able to call him postmodernist, but I think in an aesthetic sense, as someone who used all these bits and created something new, and really something entirely new, and it's never just a single source you can trace it back to. In that way, I think you should not call him a postmodernist. In fact, there are now a number of conferences coming up on Ligeti. His actual birthday, the centenary, is in May, and there will be quite a few conferences, and I will give one paper on that particular topic, and I'm just starting to flesh that out, these thoughts, how we can talk about that in more specific terms. So, yeah, I would say there are postmodern influences, and technically you might be able to call him a postmodernist, but aesthetically I don't think it's useful.
Most of us actually maybe unknowingly become aware of Ligeti's music in the Kubrick 2001 A Space Odyssey. What other films or television shows were Ligeti's music employed by the director or producer?
Yeah, I mean, this is, of course, the one that everybody has heard of and probably also most people have seen. Kubrick generally, of course, took pre-existing music and used it, which means you have to take a recording as it is and then cut the movie according to the requirements of the music, which is very unusual. Most directors don't do that. Sergio Leone did that with Morricone's music as well, to some extent, but it's very unusual. But yes, you're right. Most people know of Ligeti. It's also Ligeti's music in Kubrick's film pieces in The Shining, and then there's this short piano motif in Eyes Wide Shut, which is also by Ligeti. But we have one chapter in the book by Julia Heimerdinger, who is a musicologist in Vienna and organizes one of the upcoming Ligeti conferences in May. And she has investigated where else was this used. And it turns out in a surprising amount of films and TV series. I have to admit, most of whom I hadn't seen. One or two actually that I had seen was Godzilla, a version from 2014, where there is one of those apocalyptic moments that maybe remind me almost a bit of that Alexander's Battle painting that we mentioned earlier, where there is lots of people dying and lots of destruction. And then we get a moment from his Requiem, which is also featuring in the 2001 movie. Then there are fantasy movies, sci-fi movies. There is something from Finland, from France, from Germany, from 2010, of course, the follow-up on 2001, 2010, the year we made contact, which also features Lux Aeterna from by Ligeti. But it is a relatively small number of pieces, particularly the Requiem, Atmosphere, Continuum, and also the chamber concerto and the cello concerto that come up again and again and again. So a few of these pieces, maybe directors found that in another movie and liked it and they said, I want to use that too. I suspect it's rather that than they being really familiar with the pieces separately for their own sake. So yeah, Heimerdinger produces a list there of a number of pieces that starts actually with Kubrick. He was the first one. There is Fist of Fury, Hong Kong, Ghost Story for Christmas is a BBC series. The Shining is Kubrick again, French movie Merci la Vie, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. That is something some people may also have seen. The Tim Burton version also has the Requiem. And then some documentaries which have probably not seen that many or have had that many people watching them. Killing of a Sacred Deer, maybe another movie that people have seen, which has the cello concerto and bits from the piano concerto in it. So actually, Yorgos Lanthimos, who did that movie, has another one coming out this year. So I'm actually curious to see whether there will be some other Ligeti again in that one.
In the last part of the volume, Reading Ligeti, it's dedicated to newly discovered or unknown primary sources. Were there any surprises that you it completely, I guess, changed your perception or changed your way of thinking about Ligeti that was unveiled?
Yeah, we have three sources there. One is an interview he gave that was to be broadcast on the BBC, and then for some reason it didn't happen. And so this is released for the first time. Then the Paul Sacher Foundation in Basel, where all of Ligeti's materials are, acquired recently the correspondence with his publisher, Schott, in Mainz in Germany, and also all the corrections that he made when the scores were typeset and then printed. And thirdly, have a correspondence between Ligeti and Aliute Mecis, a stage designer and painter, who was for a while his partner in the 1970s and early 1980s. And they lived together in Berlin, except for half a year in 1972, when he was in Stanford in California, teaching there and also researching computer music in particular and other things there. And during that period, they had a correspondence going, which otherwise they didn't need. And for me, this is particularly interesting because that was completely unknown that that existed. It was discovered by the author of that chapter, Vita Guodite, in Lithuania, in an archive. And we translated, they are in German originally, the letters. We translated Ligeti's letters to her in extract. It would be much longer if we did it all. And it's quite fascinating because it shows a European who's never before been to America sort of arriving there and looking, what's life like here? It's all very strange. It's so different. I cannot go anywhere because distances are too far. So some things are very prosaic. So how do I get a bank account? It's very difficult if you don't know anything about how the system works. But also things that are, of course, more related to music. How do you teach, what it's like? And then experiences with American orchestras and conductors about how to make sure that they get his music performed in the way that he expects it to be performed so that the effects are there the way he intended them to be. And in one particular case with Zubin Mehta, who's still around, of course, but was then very young, upcoming conductor, he was not very happy at all that he's only doing this because he thinks this will maybe further his career, and he didn't do it very well and wasn't open to suggestions. And he was much better with other more traditional pieces he conducted in the same piece, in the same concert. But later on, he worked with Sei Ozawa, with whom he was much happier. So he was more open and understood, he said, the piece better. And also all sorts of things, how he then, little anecdotes almost, how he got thrown or was sort of leaving the concert hall and then couldn't get back in because he couldn't get through the main entrance because he didn't have a ticket, and he couldn't get through the back door because nobody knew him, and they said, "Oh, who are you? You can't get in here." And so it was tricky for him to get back in. And so it's quite fascinating and also funny to read. And maybe that's one of the most interesting bits because nobody saw that coming. That was an almost accidental discovery. Whereas the correspondence with his publisher is also interesting, but that's not that much of a surprise. We knew that existed. So far, people didn't have access to it, but it's interesting because he went through three different publishers in the West: Universal Edition in Vienna at the beginning, then Peters, and then Schott, who remained their main publishers for about 40 years, still are today, but with whom he worked the longest. And then it's very difficult for his intricate, very complex scores with all the rhythmic intricacies that we talked about earlier, where he says this has to be just above that in order to work and be perceived correctly by the performers. And there's a lot of back and forth about that, also about the use of color sometimes. So that's very interesting too. And it's actually, now that he's been dead now, he died in 2006, so it's 17 years. And you don't expect that much to come out anymore at this stage, new material. And it still does occasionally, and that's quite fascinating.
So I think that's all the time we have for today. But before we go, two just questions. If our listeners would want to get into Ligeti's music, do you have any pieces that you would recommend? And then the last question is there any future projects or any things coming up that you would like to share with our listeners?
Yeah. I think Lontano, the piece we talked about earlier, that Britta Suez wrote her article about, was about what the intention of the composer is versus the reaction of the audience, I think is a good piece to start with in 1967. Also, maybe the Requiem from 1965. And some of the piano etudes. There are maybe two or three in particular that do work with a specific psychological effect where all the times, all the parts keep rising. And there are so many parts at the same time, even though it's just one pianist playing. It's incredibly difficult. Not many people can play that. So that if one part ends at the right end of the keyboard, it has to end, it can't go any further, but the others keep going up, and therefore it gives you the aural impression as if it keeps going up forever. That is called the Shepard effect, after an American psychologist who discovered it, where you can create an effect as if something rises, keeps going up forever, and that piece is called the Devil's Staircase. So that that is maybe something that is one of his the 13th piano etude, Escalier le Diable. In French, he preferred for many of his pieces French titles. So maybe that is one also that one can look at, because that focuses very much on the aspect of rhythm as well, whereas these earlier pieces with the micropolyphonic texture are about spatial effects, which is why they ended up in all these movies, and particularly science fiction movies. Yeah, and what's coming up? I mean, Ligeti is a big thing this year because of the centenary, so there are quite a few productions. If people are in cities with opera houses, look out for a performance of his opera, Le Grand Macabre, which is great fun. There will also, I'm sure, where there is an orchestra, there may well be pieces by Ligeti added to the repertoire and performed this year. So I would recommend looking out for it. I've seen quite a few performances announced, for instance, of the Violin Concerto, which focuses on another thing he liked doing, which is playing with tuning systems. So that is because our normal tuning system is tempered in order to allow for transpositions into many different keys, but that doesn't matter if you are atonal, you don't go into other keys. So you can actually use instruments in different tuning systems. So he sometimes has instruments that can do that, string instruments or also brass instruments. Playing overtones, playing harmonics that are pure and not tempered, whereas other people, other instruments in the orchestra play the tempered ones. And he called that a dirty sound. And he liked that kind of tension that gives it something, again, that is not normally there. And that is something, if you listen to the Violin Concerto, the Horn Concerto, you find much of that. Also, the Viola Sonata has aspects of that. So that would be pieces from his last period, from the 1990s in particular.
Wolfgang, thank you so much for the interview.
Thank you.